honestly never thought these words would come out of my mouth, but I don't know whether the current president of the United States was with prostitutes peeing on each other in Moscow in 2013. It's possible, but I don't know.
James Comey, former FBI director, now author, starting what will be weeks of interviews promoting his new book. The tell-all pulls no punches. He compares President Trump to a mafia don. And of course, Trump is not pleased with this. He called Comey a weak and untruthful slimeball today on Twitter. Add that to Showboat and Leaker. We'll talk about that in a moment. But first, we're learning more about the work of Trump's lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen. The Wall Street Journal reports today that late last year, Cohen negotiated a $1.6 million payment from a top Republican donor and friend of Trump to a former Playboy model who claimed he impregnated her. She had an abortion. Well, that Republican fundraiser is a venture capitalist based here in Los Angeles. His name is Elliot Broidy. Broidy was the host of the big Trump fundraiser when he came through town a few weeks ago. Turns out Broidy has a checkered financial career. He pleaded guilty to bribing New York State officials in order to steer state pensions to his investment fund. Gary Baum has been digging into his life and business and politics, along with his wife, attorney Robin Rosenzweig, for The Hollywood Reporter. Hi, Gary.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, let's start with the politics. How involved is this couple in the Republican Party?
They're deeply involved. They're major financial contributors, and they are central nodes in the GOP structure.
And as I said, they were among the hosts of a Trump fundraiser a few weeks back. But they've been involved in a long time with the Republican Party, right? Way before Donald Trump?
Yes, they were. They hosted a George W. Bush fundraiser at their home in Bel Air, I believe, in 2006.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about what you have uncovered in terms of his business practices. It seems quite convoluted. Let's start first with what happened in New York.
Well, you know, he had a scandal a number of years ago in New York State where he was part of a bribery issue that took down a New York State official. And he was basically able to get off nearly scot-free by giving back some money. But he was sort of out in the political wilderness and kind of clawed his way back. What we found is that he's been involved in a number of other things. He's this sort of classic swamp creature. He's had a lot of troubles, a number of which have come out in recent weeks and months. He was involved with a U.S.-sanctioned Russian bank called VTB. He was involved in trying to shut down an investigation into embezzled public funds in Malaysia. This is known as the 1MDB scandal. He was, of course, most publicly known to have been involved in this deal in the Middle East that was connected to his private defense contractor called Sirkinis, an individual that is an associate of his that's been caught up in the Mueller investigation named George Nader.
Can you just go back and talk a little bit more about that? What was the deal with the security company, and how did that involve George Nader, who is now part of the Mueller investigation?
Well, you know, Elliot Broidy met George Nader during the inauguration, they decided to get in business together. George Nader is an advisor, or was an advisor, to the UAE, and Elliot Broidy has this defense contractor that does a number of different things. It's sort of like a kind of a Blackwater kind of operation, or a would-be Blackwater type of operation, and it wants contracts with different countries.
To provide security to private people.
To provide security to different countries and different types of things of sort of questionable potential activities. They also, you know, some of these things kind of met with Elliott Broidy's politics, which are pro-Israel and pro-Israel's allies. The UAE, of course, has been in a confrontation with Qatar, and its satellite, its broadcast entity, Al Jazeera, and that dovetailed well with Elliott Broidy's politics and his interests.
And he certainly has the ear of President Trump. Have you found any evidence that he was able to influence Trump's policy regarding Qatar? Because Trump recently sided with Saudi Arabia in a dispute against Qatar, surprising many in the foreign policy world because Qatar is hosting a large contingent of U.S. forces.
You know, it's not entirely clear. There are so many geopolitical factors at play at once, and they're overlapping. But he did have a one-on-one meeting last fall that he memorialized in a memo that was subsequently hacked and released to various media outlets, including The Hollywood Reporter, where he discussed his attempts to lobby President Trump on the UAE and Qatar issues. But it's unclear how far he was able to push certain things. He was doing a number of things at the time. He was pushing against Secretary Tillerson. He was pushing against Qatar. He was pushing against Al Jazeera in Congress. He had a number of things he was doing, had his hands in a number of different cookie jars.
And is he trying to get the Department of Justice to back off its investigation of him in this other Malaysian story you were talking about?
Well, actually, what he was doing is he and his wife were brought in essentially to quash that investigation. They weren't involved in it themselves as defendants. They were brought in, his wife is a lawyer, and she was brought in essentially as a fixer. The investigation had been ongoing for a number of years into embezzlement. For those that are unfamiliar with it, it's a multi-billion dollar issue of squandered funds. It's been an issue in Hollywood that has connected to figures like Jamie Foxx and Leonardo DiCaprio through an entity called Red Granite.
Yeah, so investing in The Wolf of Wall Street and all that. That's
exactly.
Another whole, we could spend another hour on that, but go Google it if you want to know more. One more thing before I let you go. He's also connected to Rick Gates, who is cooperating with Robert Mueller. What's the connection there?
Well, he has a number of connections to Rick Gates, including shared producers that they both worked with, producers who themselves face a number of charges for shady business dealings. And he also has shared a publicist who recently, a crisis PR publicist who recently died under unfortunate circumstances in Afghanistan. They are closely related in GOP and business circles, Rick Gates and Elliott Broidy. The Trump-Gates, Michael Cohen connections are numerous.
Okay, lots more to report, I'm sure. But I want to bring in Jonathan Weissman into the conversation, Deputy Washington Editor at The New York Times. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Okay, well, listening to all of this, it's a lot to process. What do you make of this Elliott Broidy character and his involvement with Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer?
It's stunning. You read these things and you just can't believe the era that we live in. I mean, it wasn't just that he got this enormous amount of hush money paid to this woman, but that she was on like some kind of retainer for more than a year and a half, where she was available to have sex with him for money. I mean, it's
so a prostitute, phenomenal. In other words. I mean,
it's yes, yeah, I know. The Wall Street Journal put it as kind of a sexual retainer, but obviously mm-hmm. this was more like a prostitution ring, except that we use more delicate words, I guess, when we deal with multimillionaires.
Right, and well, we've heard that Michael Cohen is now under criminal investigation. Do we know what he's being investigated for?
Well, I think that, you know, we don't actually, we have a sense of why the hush money that he paid Stephanie Clifford and the money that the National Enquirer paid Karen McDougal, the Playboy bunny, that money can be tied to illegal campaign contributions because it could be deemed illegal campaign contributions because their silence was specifically for a political purpose, not having it come out before the election of 2016. In this case, I'm not sure. We'll have to wait and see what the prosecutors say.
Okay. So there's that, and then there's James Comey and his book coming out with lots of, lots of vivid descriptions, shall we say. What stood out to you in terms of what you've been able to glean from this book? I know you haven't read it, but you've probably read the reviews.
Well, so many excerpts have come out, and, there's not a lot of bombshell material here. There's not new revelations that we haven't heard about, but we get a lot more texture. What Jim Comey thought, for instance, when Donald Trump was telling him that he demanded his loyalty, this sense that he felt like he was dealing with a mob boss. We're also just getting more of a sense of Donald Trump, this obsession that he had with the alleged tape of the prostitutes cavorting in his hotel room in the Ritz-Carlton in Moscow, that he brought it up, I think, three separate times with Comey, meaning that it was certainly something on his mind.
So, as I said earlier, the president is fighting back, and I guess I'm just wondering if this will change anyone's minds. I mean, you have people on the left saying, aha, people on the right saying, this isn't fair. Is anyone's minds going to be changed by this?
You know, I don't think so, frankly. I mean, the fact is that a lot of Democrats were very, very upset at Jim Comey at one time. They really felt like the way he handled the closing of the Clinton email scandal with that kind of broadside press conference, and then the way he reopened very temporarily the email investigation just before the election. But a lot of Democrats felt like he really handed the election to Donald Trump. But at this point, Comey is a martyr to the left. And I also don't think that this effort that the Republican National Committee is doing to make Comey out to be some kind of self-aggrandizing liar is going to work either. Some people do look at him as a little self-righteous, but I don't really think people see him as a liar the way Donald Trump is trying to make him out to be.
And quickly, what do you make of the president pardoning Scooter Libby, the George Bush official? And is this basically a signal to people like Michael Flynn, don't worry? I mean, might be pardoned in the future.
That Trump does, it's head scratchers. I mean, when was the last time you even thought about Scooter?
I know. I had to Google him a little bit to remember exactly how he was involved.
Exactly. I mean, this is kind of names from our scandals past. I mean, I think that if you want to read into it, that's exactly what you read into, that Donald Trump is not afraid to pardon and exonerate somebody who was prosecuted by a special counsel for obstruction of justice and perjury. So I suppose that people who are thinking about whether to cooperate with Bob Mueller might think, hey, if Scooter Libby could get pardoned, I could too. Maybe I'll hold out.
All right, Jonathan, always great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Jonathan Weissman. He's deputy Washington editor at the New York Times and author of the new book, Semitism, Being Jewish in America in the Age of Trump. Before that, we heard from Gary Baum, senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter. Coming up, why Facebook may not be the worst when it comes to invading your privacy. We'll tell you what Google, Comcast, and others are up to. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We've been talking a lot about Facebook this week with Mark Zuckerberg before various committees in Congress. 87 million users had their data collected without their permission in the Cambridge Analytica scandal. But other companies, Google, Comcast, Verizon, they are collecting reams of data on us as well. Searches, emails you've sent, events you've been to. For more on our privacy or lack thereof, we have Salome Soyoun on the line, a fellow at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. So what is the big takeaway from Mark Zuckerberg's testimony this week? Did you learn anything new about Facebook and how it operates and how it collects information on us?
Well, to be frank, having a little bit of an idea of how much preparation goes into preparing for a congressional hearing like this, I didn't expect to hear anything very new about Facebook, and I wasn't particularly surprised by Mark Zuckerberg's testimony. One kind of point that I did find a little surprising is that he did address taking some responsibility for the content, which is posted on the website, and that's kind of new. But from a privacy perspective, if you think the degree of surveillance and just the unfettered collection and analysis under which all of that, the data that is collected about us by companies like Facebook, if you think that sort of essential business model is the issue and the point at which our privacy is being invaded, then sort of the grilling and the promises not to share irresponsibly share data with third parties like Cambridge Analytica doesn't really make me feel any better about the situation.
Right. You don't trust that they will voluntarily do that. Well, give us a rundown of some of these other companies, because we've heard a lot about Facebook and how our data is compromised, how they know pretty much everything about us when we're either on Facebook or even offline. They're collecting data about us. But So is Google, and they probably collect more data, right?
Yeah. So the data collection business, kind of the big data business, is really broad. So you can sort of think about it, there's a general ecosystem. So there's Google, which is, like Facebook, also an edge provider. So it's an company that you're using the internet to access and engage with. And then there are internet service providers, which are sort of the wire that we're using to get there. And then there are a whole host of other companies as well. So there are, on the back end, data brokers that compile massive amounts of data that they've bought from third parties and sort of compiled and sell on to other companies, everything from insurance providers to advertisers to credit score companies, credit check companies, background check companies, all of that. And all of these companies are sort of engaged in this big data ecosystem. And a lot of them know a lot about us. Google knows where you've been. If you use Google Maps and Google stores your location, if you have location tracking turned on, which a lot of us do because that's how the map is useful, they will have a timeline. You can see where you've been from the very first day you started using Google, the time of day that you were in that location, how long you were there, how long it takes you to get from there to another location. Google knows everything you've ever searched and what searches you've deleted. They have an advertising profile on you. They know all of the apps you use. So especially if you have an Android phone, they know all of the apps that you have there. They know who you talk to on Facebook, what countries you're speaking with, what time you go to sleep. And if you don't have an Android phone, they still know that if you sync your Google Calendar with your Mac, all of your contacts, all of your appointments. They know all of your YouTube history, so all the cute times you've looked up cute dogs, cute cats. They probably know if you're going to be a parent, if you're conservative, if you're progressive, what your religion is, when you're feeling depressed. And then, of course, there are all of the apps that we've downloaded on our phone. And, you know, if you have location tracking on an app, they often sort of force you to choose between getting tracked all the time or none of the time, which if you have a weather app or you have a ride-sharing app, you kind of want your location on because that's essential to using the app. Older apps that you downloaded or that sort of existed prior to 2014 were operating under the same permissive data sharing agreements that from Facebook that allowed your friends to turn over all of your data as well if they were asked by an app.
Wow.
That's kind of how Cambridge Analytica went from 2,700 or whatever to 87 million.
So all of this information that you just outlined that Google has on us, that's never deleted?
No. So the running assumption that privacy scholars and sort of everyone who works in this space has is that once a piece of data is out there about you, you kind of need to assume that it's out there forever.
And then we don't know who Google is giving that information to necessarily, or selling that information to, I should say.
Yeah, I actually think there's a little bit of a shift here. And you see it in sort of Mark Zuckerberg's testimony, where he's really promising not to engage in this kind of careless data releases anymore. I think it is increasingly in the business interest of companies like Google and Facebook not to actually share our data, but to hold on to it and to use it to make ever more fine-grained predictions about our behavior and then sell that information to targeted advertisers. You know, our data is a very, very valuable asset. And increasingly, companies are sort of realizing they're not going to make money by turning that over for free. They're going to make money using machine learning algorithms and other forms of computational inference to sell information, the information that data provides about us.
And then you mentioned internet service providers like Comcast, Verizon, AT&T.
Mm-hmm.
And how do they collect information, and what kind of information do they collect about us, and how do they do it?
So internet service providers will generally see all the sites you visit and how much time you spend there. Also, about half of all internet traffic is encrypted, and so that means that internet service providers will not be able to see the content that is being transmitted. But for the unencrypted stuff, they can also see the content.
Even so if you do a private search?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a common misconception about incognito browsers is incognito sort of protects your browsing history. So that means somebody using your computer after you isn't going to know what you did online, but it doesn't prevent Google or an internet service provider from knowing what you did online. Again, assuming that you're using an unencrypted service. Google is encrypted, so
right.
An ISP would not be able to see that content.
Okay, and then you also mentioned, so there are data brokers, but also the people or the companies they sell that data to, and you mentioned insurance brokers.
Mm-hmm.
As well. And so how do insurance companies track us, and what do they know about us?
So insurance companies, well, our health-related data is protected by HIPAA.
Yeah.
And so there are some protections in place there, and the same with financial data. There are some sector-specific protections there. But increasingly, sort of the profiles that exist about us and that data brokers can compile, there's a lot of uses for that you can imagine. Credit score companies or insurance companies would be interested in knowing. So if you use a fitness tracker or a health tracker, information from that or data from that about how often you go to the gym or sort of calorie trackers, what sort of food you're eating, you can imagine that would be really valuable for insurance companies when deciding what sort of premiums to give different different individuals.
Okay, well, thank you so much for the reality check.
Yeah, it's a depressing area to be in.
Yeah. That's Salome Soyoun. She's a fellow in the Privacy Initiatives Project at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Coming up, A Ray of Sunshine, we'll have movie reviews, including Rampage, starring Dwayne Johnson and a gorilla.
The Rock is our Jane Goodall here.
Right. Better than Jane Goodall.
Well, if Jane Goodall had been Special Forces.
Right.
Alonzo Duralde and Dave White are here with your reviews next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Friday, time for movie reviews. This week's new releases include another big action movie from the future president, The Rock. Just kidding. The Rock 2020 is fake news, at least for now. Not fake news, film critics Dave White and Alonzo Duralde in the studio with me. Hello.
Hello.
Howdy.
Howdy. Okay, let's talk about The Rock. He plays a primatologist in this movie, Rampage, and he shares a strong bond with a gorilla named George.
Last night, George was 7 feet and he weighed 500 pounds. George, you okay, buddy? You're scared. It's okay. This morning, he's 9 feet pushing 1,000. What's happening to my friend?
Alonzo, what's happening?
Well, as will often happen, experimental genetic material that was in a space station comes crashing down to Earth.
Of course.
You know.
As it does.
And makes a gorilla, a wolf, and a lizard into really giant, scary, terrible things.
Crocodile.
Is it a crocodile? Oh, well, okay.
Well.
It becomes a crocodile, but it also...
The space
part
molecules land in the Everglades.
Why are you insisting on logic, Dave?
The wolf is also part...
I just like to get things correct.
The wolf is also part porcupine. You know, it's a thing that happens.
But George and The Rock, they have a thing.
They have a bond, but as George becomes bigger and more aggressive, only The Rock can save us. And with the help of Naomi Harris as a PhD geneticist.
Dave?
Well.
I don't even know what to ask you.
Sometimes in cinema, animals become the size of buildings and they fight.
So is this supposed to be King Kong?
Well,
no.
It's based on a video game.
Yes.
Oh.
And one could make the case that it is the best video game adaptation ever, only because that is about the lowest bar you can find in modern movies.
Why is George a white gorilla?
He's an albino.
Okay.
Who was rescued by The Rock a baby from poachers.
I think they wanted him to look a little bit like the abominable snowman from Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Which everybody loves.
Bumble's Bounce.
Yeah.
But he's scary in the trailer.
Well, see, here's the thing. He's scary in the trailer. But when the film begins, they anthropomorphize this digital creation so well that he and Dwayne The Rock Johnson can communicate.
With sign language.
Primarily with sign language. But sometimes The Rock isn't even moving his hands and he's just having a conversation. With the gorilla, and the gorilla's like, yes, I think so, too. Yeah, and so...
The Rock is our Jane Goodall here.
Right. Better than Jane Goodall. Like...
Well, if Jane Goodall had been Special Forces.
Right.
And if she pumped some iron.
Yeah. And if she was just better at her job.
Yeah.
Like The Rock is.
If she could save the world, like The Rock can.
So... Quit slacking Jane Goodall.
Alonzo and I have a bit of a disagreement on this film. He thinks it's a little less awesome than I do.
Uh-huh. Are you being sarcastic?
No. He's not so much of a fan. Am I right about that?
I've heard people raving about how wonderfully stupid this movie is and how it's incredibly entertaining. And I will agree on the stupid part. But I was not as consistently as entertained as I think Dave and others have been.
But laughing at.
And with. And Alonzo and I both, as young children, were big fans of the Japanese kaiju.
Mm-hmm.
And this film refers back to that quite a bit. There are some inventive, silly ways that the giant animals create destruction.
Chicago gets it again.
Again, yeah. But, you know, there'll be like really fun moments where, you know, one of the animals will pick up a giant boat of tourists and just throw it. And you think, okay, well, all those people died, but this is really fun. Okay.
That wolf just ate that helicopter and everybody in it.
Right. But as the film progresses and the fighting gets more intense, it made me think to myself, well, if I had a little kid here with me, I don't know that I would want that little kid being exposed to this kind of brutality. Also, and this is a spoiler, and I don't care that it's a spoiler because it annoyed me so much, there's a moment where a legitimate geneticist, Naomi Harris, is sexually harassed by a gorilla. And I didn't think that was necessary in this film. It offended me.
Or ever.
It bothered me. And I thought, hey, movie, you were being kind of lighthearted and weird until now, and now you're being a little too real and gross.
You were better than that, Rampage.
Yeah.
Just by a hair.
So mostly good, some things not so good.
Okay. Yeah. Next up, another horror film from the prolific Blumhouse Productions. It stars Lucy Hale from Pretty Little Liars and Tyler Posey from Teen Wolf. Here's a clip.
Hey, Olivia. Truth or dare? What did you say?
Truth or dare?
Truth or dare? Truth or dare?
Truth or dare? Okay, we get it. Well, all right,
now,
I guess the name of this movie...
Now that the branding has been established...
...is what? What is the name of this movie?
In Bed with Madonna.
Is this... if only...
That was what Truth or Dare was called in other countries. The Madonna documentary.
Was it
Did
really?
You know
in
that?
Bed with Madonna.
That's a cinema fact, yeah.
Oh, well, thank you for that.
So Jeff Wadlow, whose previous best credit was Kick-Ass 2, has directed this film that is not scary at all, but isn't boring. It is about a group of college kids who go on spring break to Mexico and almost immediately and without question follow a stranger to a second location where they are promised partying. And so they go off to this abandoned church slash mission that looks really like a terrifying haunted house. And they go in and they begin playing Truth or Dare. And it turns out that the stranger has led them there to tag them into the game of Truth or Dare, which is supernatural. And they have to play the game or they die. So shades of the Final Destination movies where death is stalking these kids and they cannot escape the game until they break the curse of the blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. It incorporates the language and the rituals and the aesthetics of social media. They even describe the weird, scary, supernatural face, smiley face that they all get when they say truth or dare to each other is a weird Snapchat filter.
Oh, really?
So the way they're talking to each other about this is very much informed by the world of viral videos and people breaking privacy and exposing each other on the internet and all of these things that are part of being young and online.
But that sounds interesting. Is it interesting?
Those elements of it are interesting. They don't really add up to something. Mm. They're just recognizable, like, signposts for the young target audience
also,
to catch on to.
We get a potential victim who's gay, which I'm very excited
Equal
about.
Equal gay murder rights
That's
in horror
right.
films.
If you're going to kill all the nubile college students, I want LGBT inclusion.
This is one of the conversations that Alonzo and I have been having post Love, Simon as queer adult men film critics. We want all movies from out of Hollywood for the next 30 years to have at least one queer character in it just for
parody.
Just to make a little more balance.
Okay.
And so here we got one. And we have one in Blockers, too.
And
so
person,
good going, Hollywood.
That person does get killed.
We're not going to say, but they're in the mix.
Last up, the film The Rider. It won the Art Cinema Award at Cannes last year. It's about a rodeo cowboy who suffers a near-fatal head injury. Here's a clip.
Sometimes dreams aren't meant to be.
Who's this?
That's Apollo.
Wow, that's amazing. A horse that never had nobody on his back before.
Where are you going with that?
I'm going to the rodeo.
You don't need to go ride today.
I'm entered and I'm riding.
Go kill yourself then.
Okay, Alonzo, set this up for us. This is about Brady Gendreau. He's
right.
A real rodeo player playing himself.
Yes, he is. He's playing he's different last name, but he's playing a version of himself. In real life, he had a career-ending accident where a horse stepped on his head and he cannot ride horses anymore. So, In real life. Mm-hmm. So he's playing basically the same thing in the film. Chloe Zhao is a Chinese-born filmmaker who's been living in the United States. She has been living on this reservation. It's a Lakota reservation. She made a previous film there called Songs My Brothers Taught Me. And once she got to know Brady and his story, she decided to make her next film about him. And so he plays himself. His sister plays his sister. His father plays his father. His friends play his friends. And it's a movie about what happens when you have set up your life to do a certain thing and accomplish a certain thing and to use the talents that you have. And then that's taken away from you. What do you become? And you know, I think this is a, there's a lot. I like this movie less than most people, but I still like it a lot. It's shot by Joshua James Richards, who did God's Own Country last year. And the film has a very sort of Terrence Malick, you know, the people and the land kind mm-hmm. of quality, and how people are the product of the nature of where they live. The performances are very subtle and powerful, and Jandro, even though he's, you know, playing yourself is a challenging thing, and he does so really well. And this guy could be in the movies if he chooses to be at this point. But at the same time, I feel like the only qualms I have is, one, I feel like the movie feels a little divorced from the political and societal circumstances that trap the people into having the limited choices that they have, and that the movie doesn't cover that in any significant way, which I feel is a bit of an absence. And also, I wonder if a like male NYU student from Minnesota had made this movie, would we accuse him of exploiting this guy and his personal tragedy and making him relive it in a movie?
Do you feel it's exploitative?
Not at all. Alonzo's wrong in not liking it enough.
Uh-huh. Go on.
There is something to be said about telling a story that you're qualified to tell. I agree with that. However, if you live in a place and you are an outsider and the people who live in that place say to you, yeah, sure, make a movie about us, and they're collaborating with you, and this is a collaborative effort. This isn't exploitation at all. This is clearly a community-based film. The family plays the family. The friends mm-hmm. play the friends.
So why not make a documentary?
Well, you know, the documentary would be less narratively compelling, wouldn't it?
it would seem less immediate because it would be about things that already happened versus this mm-hmm. allows them to tell the yeah. story as though it were unfolding.
Yeah. So you said Terrence Malick, and I understand that. I get it. But I was really thinking more of the films of Kelly Reichardt than Malick, because there is that intimacy, and there is that personal quality to it that I don't often see in recent Malick films. I think of him as being sort of very presentational and not.
I'm thinking the vintage Malick
involved with
like
his,
a lot of golden
characters.
Hour shots.
Yeah.
Yeah,
this is a tough film, but it's beautiful to look at, and it's a very graceful and tender and kind-hearted film about not just a chosen way of life, but a way of life that you were born into, and it's part of who you are. It's about being a person, an indigenous person in the United States who is often, you know, stuck in place. And I think the politics that you say aren't there are there visually right in front of you.
So the actor is actually
Lakota.
Part of a
yes.
Sioux tribe, right?
Lakota. Yeah. And so it's about that feeling of being stuck and about butting up against ideas of codes of masculinity
yes.
that are keeping him in a spot where he doesn't know what to do anymore. You know, his friends are saying, well, you just got to get back up on that horse. And he's like, I know what the doctor said, you
yeah.
know. And so that is where he finds himself.
It would make a very powerful and very depressing double feature with another film that's in release right now called Lean on Pete, which is also about a young man and his relationship to horses.
They're
different they're thematically different. And narratively, but I think they have a lot in common. They have a poignancy and a lyricism in common.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does seem to be a genre, obviously Westerns, but aside from that, the relationship between man and beast, and I'm not yep. talking about The Rock but horses in particular have something.
You do get to see this, you get to see Brady train horses, and it is exciting to watch him take a horse that is bucking and not, you know, responding to commands, and the way that he can gently communicate and get it to do things and respond to certain commands. It's breathtaking. And you sense the loss of this guy not being able to ride horses, be around horses because of this head trauma.
It did make me think, why don't rodeo riders wear helmets?
Well, because they don't. Yeah. It's a beautiful film. Definitely go see it.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Dave White and Alonzo Duralde both review for The Wrap and host the Linoleum Knife podcast. Coming up, why ice hockey is playing really well in Las Vegas, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The LA Kings are in Vegas, but hopefully they're not out gambling on the strip because they have a job to do. They're in the first round of the playoffs against the Las Vegas Golden Knights. The Knights are a first-year expansion team, but unlike most first-year teams, they're good. Really good. They won the Western Conference and have home ice advantage in at least the first two rounds of the playoffs. Tom Spousta is assistant sports editor for the Las Vegas Review-Journal, and he joins us now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Good to be with you. And that gambling part, you're correct. There was a thing called the Vegas flu earlier in the season.
Oh, interesting.
To play. So
the
I think
flu
that got
at
them
the
a few
slot
victories.
Machines. Okay, so how did this happen? How did this expansion team end up doing so well in its first year?
You know, we've been scratching our heads all season, but I mean, it's just a confluence of factors. It's really one of the, you know, the universe speaks kind of thing. And a lot of it had to do with the bonding between the city and the team over the October 1st shooting.
Oh, yeah, the mass shooting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they opened their first two games on the road, and they came back on October 10th, and the team had switched around from this glitzy Vegas opening act type thing for the inaugural game. And it became more of a somber thing where they honored the victims, and Derek England, who a longtime Las Vegas resident, gave this heartfelt speech. It was 75 word speech. He took it out over 58 seconds, which there were 58 victims, and it just went from there. A city and a team bonded, and they really helped them heal and grieve. And it's just here we are six months later.
Well, okay, so the city really loves them, and they're doing really well. Does the stadium sell out?
It sells out over capacity. They have a standing room only area. They got 18,004 last game against the Kings. It seats like 17,300, something like that. T-Mobile Arena. So they've been every game has been beyond capacity.
Does it have anything at all to do with their pregame show?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you got it's Vegas. You know, they got to put on a show. It's one of the few I've covered pretty much everything in sports, but I've never seen fans get there about 20 minutes early, and they're in their seats 15, 20 minutes before the start of the pregame show.
What happens at the pregame show?
The laser lights, some pyrotechnics. This last game they rolled out, and this is the first time they did it. They had a giant Golden Knight helmet that they lowered down where the team skates out from the locker room. And that thing, the fans just went nuts over that. When the players came out, hit the ice, and skated through the helmet onto the ice, just added another element to the pregame show that they put on. They also have a knight who like pulls Excalibur out of a rock, and then he like fends off some of the Pacific Division foes as they try to take the Excalibur away from them. So they've tapped into just about everything.
Right. Well, I guess they kind of did that on Wednesday when they beat the Kings 1-0.
Yeah.
So what do you expect tonight? Because they're playing again tonight.
I think it might even be amped up a little more than the first game. I think eventually things will settle down because the hockey playoffs are such a grind. But I have no idea. I'm sure they'll do the Golden Knight thing again. The three members of the Blue Man Group were spotted in the crowd, and they put the kiss cam on them during the game, which, of course, you know, the Blue Man, they don't talk or certainly don't kiss in public. And then they had a couple people come up and hug them, and the blue paint was on their face. So, you know, some of
it's a good time.
some of it's cheesy, but it's a good time and it's Las Vegas.
Right. Okay. And so meanwhile, the Raiders, Oakland Raiders, are moving to Las Vegas in a few years, right?
Yeah. And, you know, we've gotten kind of a mixed response. There's a large Raider base of fans. Raiders are one of those national franchises. You know, and it's like the Dallas Cowboys, the Green Bay Packers, the Raiders. They're a national brand. So in a lot of California transplants, a lot of people from Los Angeles for when the Raiders played in L.A. are over here. But they're a team that's transplanted from Oakland. Okay, the Knights were homegrown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had to draft their own players. They had to start from scratch. So, you know, the NFL's the NFL. I think the Raiders will get another huge response. But as far as that emotional, heartfelt thing, I'm not sure that's going to happen in 2020 when the Raiders get down to Las Vegas.
Well, you never know.
That's right.
You never know. Tom Spousta, assistant sports editor for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
Pretty much how I feel every time Christian Bordahl comes into the studio. No, I jest.
Only today, Friday the 13th.
So you're here with some facts.
I've been
about
looking
Friday
into
the
Friday
13th.
The 13th a little bit. Try this on for side. Triskaidekaphobia.
Uh-huh.
Or
I'm not gonna say that.
That's fear of number 13.
Okay.
Even better, paraskevidekatriophobia. That is fear of Friday the 13th in particular. Hopefully you're not a paraskevidekatriophobic.
Ooh,
Madeline.
Good one.
Yeah.
Points for that.
Thank you. According to the Stress Management Center and Phobia Institute in Asheville, North Carolina, they estimate that some 17 to 21 million Americans are in fact afraid of today, Friday the 13th. Anything from mild anxiety and a nagging sense of doom to full-blown panic attacks.
Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So how did that even become a thing?
Why
Friday the 13th?
Because everyone knows that, first of all, the number 13 is an unlucky and dangerous number.
Where did that come from?
Well, I mean, you don't have tall buildings, you know, built without a number 13 floor or a 13th street not existing in a place like Santa Monica if there's nothing, you know, if there's no there, obviously it's a dangerous thing.
The number 13.
The number 13, yeah.
Okay.
Apparently it gets its stigma from a couple of dinner parties. Jesus' Last Supper,
okay.
12 disciples and him, the 13th guest was Judas. Also, interestingly, 12 guests at a dinner party one time at Valhalla, Odin's Hall, you know, in Asgard.
Of course.
Loki shows up, the bad boy, the black sheep of the family, all hell breaks loose, one of the gods dies, it's a bad time, and so since then, it's been a bad idea to have 13 guests at supper. In fact, no less than Franklin Delano Roosevelt himself didn't like to have 13 guests at the supper table.
Oh, fascinating. Mm-hmm. Okay, but what about the Friday part?
So the Friday part, back to Christian theology, Friday is generally thought of as the day when Jesus was crucified, Good Friday. So that's a day of kind of penance and abstinence. And as far back as the 14th century, Chaucer wrote in the Canterbury Tales about Friday being a day of misfortune. So you put the two together, and Friday the 13th.
And then you have lots of movies with that
you
name
have
in
lots
it.
Lots of movies, exactly. Lots of movies. Actually, there was a book first in 1907 that came out called Friday the 13th by a stock market promoter named Thomas Lawson. And it was all about a stockbroker who chooses Friday the 13th as the day to crash the market. And from there, it kind of took on a life of its own, including the movies, of course.
So I wonder if the real market is affected.
The real market is apparently generally affected. It's usually down on today. And I'm just going to refresh my page here and see what is happening with it. It's down now just over 100 points.
Really?
So yes, indeed. It was down like up at around 200 points at one point, but now it's down about 100, so about 0.5% of the Dow Jones.
And you're going to blame it all on Friday the 13th.
And of course, you can fly cheaper today because there are people out there who don't want to fly.
Well, a lot of airplanes don't have number 13 on the roads. Right?
I haven't noticed that, but I guess that could be true, yeah. So just make sure you don't, you know, step on any cracks or break any mirrors today, Madeline Brandt.
You know, I got married on a Friday the 13th.
That's fantastic.
And it was good luck for me. So
wow.
All right. Thank you, Christian Bartle.
You're welcome. Do you want some salt?
No, thanks. No, I'll just knock on wood. Thanks. All right. Okay, that's it for Press Play. Our show is directed by Sarah Sweeney, produced by Amy Ta, Christian Bartle, Michelle Aloy, Gina Pollack, and Yael Evan Orr. Quinn O'Toole is our managing producer, Mario Saavedra, and Phil Richards engineered for us Alexandra Sif Trygvadottir. Ah, that's a great name. She's Icelandic. She's our new intern. That's it for us. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great weekend, the 14th and the 15th. I'll see you on Monday.